good to see you all again this evening. Glad you have made it back out to echo some of the comments made earlier today. Just be mindful of those who are sick in our number. A lot of the reason why we've dropped today is because that cold is going around. The sales came back from Colorado ill. Two of our elders are out sick right now, so just cover your mouths and wash your hands and just pray for those who have the bug. This evening, if you want to open your Bibles to Ecclesiastes chapter 1, we're going to be picking up where we began last week and looking at this next section of the text. And a reminder, the questionnaire, the study guide for this section of text is available in the back on our little paper holder thing where you can get the duty rosters as well. Because again, what we're covering tonight, we will cover in further detail Wednesday night during our midweek class. But tonight, we've entitled this of I'm Just Passing Through. Just a passing through, and several of our hymns that we sing carry this whole idea of Christians are supposed to be or supposed to have the mindset of a pilgrim. We're temporary here on this earth. We're not meant to try and dwell here or live here for eternity. Our time here is brief. And really to start off tonight's study, trying to think about how we view life and how we view our possessions and where we're going and how we're going and so forth like that is, are we carrying a backpack or a U-Haul with us as far as what we're trying to achieve in this life? Christians are not to and do not find permanent rest in this life. Rest from toil, rest from labors, none of that is found here. Now granted, in Christ, for example, going to Matthew chapter 11, we do find rest from our weariness and our burdens. We find Christ to be an infinitely merciful master. And as Paul has told us in later epistles, we're told that upon God or Christ that we should cast all of our burdens and anxieties. But you're looking at Matthew chapter 11, starting in verse 28. It says, "Come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. My yoke is easy and my burden is light." Again, he's emphasizing the soul part. From the burdens and the weariness of this life, we do find rest in Christ, but ultimate weariness, our ultimate rest or permanent rest is not found while we dwell in these mortal bodies. Christ in the gospel does not promise us whatsoever a life of ease. You want to turn to Hebrews. In fact, what we see often, what we see to be the mindset of the Lord's people, of God's people, has been that they rightfully understood themselves to be nothing but strangers in this land. In the book of Hebrews, the 11th chapter, and talking about the great characters of faith and what made them great, speaking of, I believe, Abraham here in chapter 11, starting in verse 9, speaking of Abraham, he says, "By faith, he lived as an alien in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promise. For he was looking for a city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God." By faith, stopping at verse 10. The question comes up then is, would God be able to use that description for us living here on this earth? If Hebrews chapter 11 were to be written today, and say one of us were fortunate enough to be included in that chapter, could God honestly say about you and I that we were living in Tucson, Arizona as an alien and a stranger? As one who was out of step? Or would the Lord find that we were just right in step with how the culture is, but the aims and pursuits of this life? I like how David Gibson again put it in that book, Living Life Backwards. He said, "People who follow Jesus often lose sight of the world to come. We become resident Christians rather than nomadic Christians. We become fully integrated in this world rather than viewing ourselves as passing through. And we do this by living as if our greatest treasures are the here and now." We covered some of this in class Wednesday night. But many Christians, why verbally, will profess to be Christians. By how they live and how they act, they are practical atheists. It's a life devoid of faith. It's a life completely centered upon relying upon self. It's a life that centers and focuses and hangs anxiety and cares about the here and now instead of what is to come. Again, thinking back to Hebrews chapter 11, talking about Abraham, what made him a great character of faith was he suffered a lot. He went through a lot in his lifetime. He had great wealth and he lost part of it. I mean, he went to war. He experienced a wide range of human experience. But even despite that wealth, despite his fame and everything else, he did not rest upon that. He believed God, and as the text says, it was reckoned to him as righteousness. It was by faith that he lived his life, not trusting in self or riches, but in what was to come hereafter. And American Christians especially, because we do live in a society that is abundant. In fact, a preview of coming attractions next Sunday morning, we'll be looking at three stories from the Gospel of Luke about wealth, possessions, and how they affect me, and how actually one of the most common sins Christians commit today is that of covetousness. But this is found here in Ecclesiastes, of what am I putting my trust in? What am I resting in? Is it my possessions in this life, or is it the hereafter? Am I traveling with a backpack as a nomad, or am I traveling with a U-Haul looking for some place to settle down in this life? You look in Matthew real quick in the 6th chapter, and this is all prefacing our study tonight. But in Matthew chapter 6, looking at starting verse 19 is where we're going to be at. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where the thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroy, where thieves do not break in or steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart also be. The section of Ecclesiastes we're going to be covering tonight, as one writer put it, helps us from doing the wrong kind of storing, the wrong kind of storing, and helps us to do the right kind of storing. It pops these bubbles of pretend that we live in, and helps us to stop storing up treasures in this life and start focusing on what truly matters. And I'm going to give away part of the ending, is we start seeing the first glimmer of light in Ecclesiastes tonight towards the end of chapter 2. So approaching this section of the text, going back to Ecclesiastes 1, and we're going to be in verse 12, there's three ways we're going to be looking at this, and I believe this is how the text develops itself. And just full disclosure, this is how David Gibson put it out in his book. I thought it was very apt. I thought it was truthful. I thought the scriptures support it, so that's why it's going to be our approach tonight. We're going to see in the first section the great human pursuits of how man strives and works and toils to try and gain some sort of meaning in life. And we're going to see how all that is kind of just tossed away by the permanent human problem of death. And as we end it tonight, we'll be looking at the true human perspective of how we can truly enjoy this life. So getting right into it, the great human pursuit. Ecclesiastes 1, starting in verse 12. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem. And I set my mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven. It is a grievous task which God has given the sons of men to be afflicted with. I have seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after the wind. What is crooked cannot be straightened, and what is lacking cannot be counted. I said to myself, behold, I have magnified and increased wisdom more than all who are over Jerusalem before me. My mind has observed a wealth of wisdom and of knowledge. And I set my mind to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. And I realized that this also is striving after the wind. Because in much wisdom there was much grief, and increasing knowledge results in increasing pain. I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure, so enjoy yourself. And behold, it too was futility. I said of laughter, it is madness, and of pleasure, what does it accomplish? I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body, with wine why my mind was guiding me wisely, and how to take hold of folly until I could see what good there was for the sons of men to do under heaven the few years of their lives. I enlarged my works. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks for myself. I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made ponds of water for myself from which to irrigate a forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves, and I had homeborn slaves. Also, I possessed flocks and herds larger than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. Also, I collected for myself silver and gold, and the treasure of kings and provinces. I provided for myself male and female singers, and the pleasures of men many concubines. Then I became great, and increased more than all who preceded me in Jerusalem. My wisdom also stood by me. All that my eyes desired I did not refuse. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure. For my heart was pleased because of all my labor, and this was my reward for all my labor. Thus I considered all my activities which my hands had done and the labor which I had exerted, and behold, all was vanity and striving after the wind, and there was no profit under the sun. So I turned to consider wisdom, madness, and folly. For what will the man do who will come after the king except which has already been done? And I saw that wisdom excels folly, and light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in his darkness. And yet I know that one fate befalls them both. We'll pause here real quick. The first stop in the writer is the writer's going. He's starting to explain, the wisdom writer, after he's gone through that first explosive entry of chapter 1. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity, says the preacher. He talks about how the world is never ending, that the eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear is satisfied with hearing. There is no point in our lives at which we can sit back and say, I've seen it all, I've heard it all, I've done it all, and actually mean that. Not the sarcastic thing when we've seen something we can't believe and we utter, oh, well, I thought I saw it all, or I've seen it all now. And he talks about his course of life. And really, what he's speaking of here is, and how he's approaching this, he is speaking from, in a sense, bitter experience. The things that he has done in this life, what he's experienced and what he has done and how it resulted in nothing. First stop is Jerusalem University, if you want to use that phrase, where he sought to explore his mind and expand his knowledge. He was the first-year philosophy student at a local university who, when he comes home, thinks he knows how the whole universe works, only to find out that he knows nothing. So he sought, how to expand his mind with wisdom. And what we're going to see here too, backing up just a moment, is Solomon, just like you and I, there is a lofty goal of happiness in this life that we want. We want to be satisfied, we want to experience joy, we want to have happiness. In fact, almost all, I would say all the pursuits of mankind are centered around that. Why does the person work 70 hours at the office a week? So he can have the money and the overtime and the vacation days to finally enjoy life for a little bit. Why do we get ourselves into so much debt with new cars and toys and boats and large houses is because we think that somehow that's going to bring us happiness. Or if I could just get the next promotion, the next thing, there's always a next thing. We're all trying to fill that God-shaped hole in ourselves with things, pursuits, and pleasures, and wealth, and wisdom, and it will not accomplish it. And so Solomon had to learn the hard way, and I think the tone of his voice indicates as such. But you look at the wisdom, it has its limits. You look at verse 18, because in much wisdom there was much grief, and increasing knowledge results in increasing pain. I remember an episode of the show House, that medical drama that was on TV for a number of years starring Hugh Lowry. There was an episode where this man, they found out that actually he was intentionally taking high quantities of cough syrup back when they put codeine in cough syrup, to drug himself out because his high intellect. And the woman he married had a much lower intellect where he just could not have conversations with her. And so a solution for him was, I'm going to make myself higher than a kite so I can bring myself down to her level. And the thing was, I'm happy at this. Because for him and his increased wisdom, if you want to call it that, or knowledge, there was great pain and suffering. It was futility. That's just one, I guess, fictitious example of that, but the more you know, the more you wish you didn't know, in a sense. They say that ignorance is bliss, but there's a balance, but you know, knowledge has its limits, and this is what Solomon's trying to get us to understand here. Now, wisdom has its place, but there is such a thing as too much, and wisdom itself is not the answer or to give meaning or joy in this life. There's the phrase we've all heard, those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it. We had the joke in the history department at my university was, and those who do study history are doomed to watch others repeat it. Because you can't prevent other people from doing it. And you having the knowledge oftentimes puts you in frustrating situations where you can tell how it's going to go. I can imagine Solomon in his old age is seeing his own sons and relatives and just random people in the streets of Jerusalem going down the same path he went, and he has all this knowledge, and no one's listening. You think of his own son and how that turned out. That's the first stop. And then when he realizes knowledge, there's no means to a gain. There's no profit in that. And again, when we talk about profit, it's not talking about there's no benefit to it. There is benefit to wisdom. There is benefit to some pleasure. There is benefit to those things. But we're talking about ultimate gain, some sort of legacy, some sort of lasting impact on this world. And so I'm saying in wisdom, there is no gain. There is no profit. And pleasure for pleasure's sake doesn't give anything either. You look in the next section, the first 11 verses of chapter 12. He did it all. He built the dream home with the four-car garage and the expansive kitchen and the great study. He had the fire pit and the swimming pool in the backyard. He had the servants and the maids and the butlers, everything that us common folk dream about, right? He did it. He did not withhold anything from it, on possessions, on experiences. He was like those college, that's from my own personal experience. I always was perplexed at my classmates in college that every spring break they were every vacation basically they were able to afford to go to Tahiti or something. I'm like, you're a poor college student just like me, right? How are you able to afford this kind of stuff? I know I wasn't. But he's the guy. He gets to do all that stuff. He withheld nothing from him. And you look in verse 11. Thus I consider all my activities, the wealth, the pleasure, the buildings, everything, all the vacations which my hands had done and the labor which I exerted. And behold, all was vanity and striving after the wind, and there was no profit under the sun. There was no gain. There was no surplus. There was no lasting impact. What Solomon is experiencing here is what many in the world experience and what many of us have experienced. To have grabbed pleasure by the horns, to have it for a moment, to rein it in, and just when you think you're about ready to have some sort of thing that's going to last, it slips away like smoke, only for us to find the next thing to try and fill that hole again. But the problem is, again, with pleasure, pursuits, materialism, there's always the next thing. I'm reminded of a time when any time we got a new car in the household. Now, my dad still treats his Camaro this way. But when he got that Camaro, every single day, just about, he's out there making sure there's no dents and he's waxing it and everything else. And he's making sure all the carpets get vacuumed every week. He is meticulous trying to take care of that. Now, he still cares about making sure there's no dents and he still washes every week. But, you know, the newness has worn off. He's not so picky anymore about if some dirt and stuff gets in on the floorboards. You know, that he can vacuum that out. Or I think a better way was with his truck. He did the same thing with the truck, but it's his work truck. And now it's got the same worn-in smell of Starbucks coffee and BO that his old work truck had. The newness wore off. And that's what happens when we pursue either trying to find meaning or lasting impact in our life, either through our jobs, our possessions, just having a good time. The newness wears off. Now, some of you may disagree with me on this point. First time you go to Disneyland, it's phenomenal. And I would say the second time is. I still need a test the third time because I've only gone twice. But my grandma, who grew up in El Cajon, you know, much closer to Disneyland than we are, every year the class field trip was Disneyland. Every year for 12 years. Every company picnic, everything. So where she still has fun, but she's like, yeah, I've seen it multiple times. Again, the newness wears off. So what about living wisely then? Surely that's going to have some sort of benefit. Solomon goes on that a wise life, and he admits in the text, it is good. It is good for us. It is better. Living a wise life at the end still has no lasting impact as far as profit goes in this life. Some sort of deep impact on this world. You'll look again here in verse 12. So after he's tried all these things, so he said, I turn to consider wisdom, madness, and folly. For what will the man do who will come after the king except what shall have been done? And I saw that wisdom excels folly. There is benefit to wisdom, a wise life. And lightness stood over darkness. But he says there, it looks like it's going pretty well in the text, but we're going to go to the next section. A wise life is infinitely better than a foolish life. Lightness is infinitely better than darkness. But you look at the end of verse 14. And yet I know that one fate befalls them both the wise man and the foolish. And we come to the permanent human problem that mankind has. Look in verse 15. And we'll read through verse 23. Then I said to myself, as is the fate of the fool, it will also befall me. Why then have I become extremely wise? So I said to myself, this too is vanity. For there is no lasting remembrance of the wise man as with the fool. Inasmuch as in the coming days all will be forgotten. And how the wise man and the fool alike die. So I hated life, for the work which had been done under the sun was grievous to me, because everything is futility and striving after the wind. Thus I hated all the fruit of my labor, for which I had labored under the sun. For I must leave it to another man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool? Yet he will have control over all the fruit of my labor for which I have labored by acting wisely under the sun. This too is vanity. Therefore I completely despaired all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun. When there is a man who has labored with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, then he gives his legacy to one who has not labored with them. This too is vanity and a great evil. For what does man get in all his labor and all his striving which he labors under the sun? Because all his days his task is painful and grievous. Even at night his mind does not rest. This too is vanity. The wake-up call in the text. He starts wising up at the end of verse 14, but in 15 he realizes you can't change reality. You can build this great legacy. You can act wisely. You can live a righteous life. Build the wealth. And even if you are meticulous in your last will and testament and you write out who gets what and the stipulations and everything else, and it may be legally binding, when you die, everything you have goes to another. And his whole point was, I don't know if they're going to be wise or they're going to be a fool. I mean, you think of some of the families in this country who have made great wealth. The Rockefellers and the Carnegies. Now, Carnegie especially, there's a reason why almost every city has some sort of Carnegie library or hospital. Carnegie believed it was bad, it was a sin for him to die with all that wealth, so he left it in a trust to keep on doing good after he died. The Rockefeller family ended up managing that wealth even to this day. They're the lucky ones. I think the more realistic example of what happens when somebody gets a vast amount of money, as Solomon's saying, without working, without toiling. Look at any of the documentaries that follow people who win the lottery. You know, 2, 3, 5 years down the road. A lot of them, their relationships end up being destroyed. They've lost it all. They're back working again. Or they've gotten themselves into 10 times more debt than they ever thought they possibly could have before they won. And the thing is, with our legacy, our physical possessions, our wealth, who knows who will come after us, whether they be a fool or a wise man. Of course, my parents always joke with me, says, the only thing you're probably going to inherit is our debt. So, good luck with that. But his whole point here is, the wise man, the foolish man, they all end up in the same place. And now, unfortunately, the writer, we're back to where we began with in Ecclesiastes 1. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. You can kind of see this Solomon throwing his hands up in the air and said, this is hopeless. I won't do this anymore. But thankfully for us, the text doesn't end there. Again, everyone ends up in the same point. And so he asks the question there in verses 18 through 21, what's the point of my labor? What's the ultimate point of any of this? I mean, you look at verse 17, so I hated life. And you look at verse 18, I hated all the fruit of my labor. And verse 20, I completely despaired at all the fruit of my labor which I had labored under the sun. When there is a man who has labored with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, he gives his legacy to one who has not labored with them. This too is vanity and a great evil. Basically saying it's not fair that I should work my entire life in wisdom and prudence to labor by the sweat of my brow and to break my back and then have my legacy, my profit, given to another. So he's despairing. Why do I did any of this? What was the point? And the thing is, and this is going to sound weird to begin with, and I think next section we're going to see how rewarding this actually is. What is the point? There is no point. And that's not some sort of nihilistic, woe is me, we're all going to die. That's the thing. We get so wrapped up in there must having to be a point that we view all of our labor, all the pursuits of this life, as a means to an end, as something we can use, instead of it being the end of it in of itself. Let's see what I'm talking about here in the next section. So he's just despaired. I've hated all the labor. What point is there? It's not fair that my legacy goes to another. But he says in verse 24, there is nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen is from the hand of God. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him? For to a person who is good in his sight, he has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, while to the sinner, he has given the task of gathering and collecting, so that he may give to the one who is good in God's sight. This too is vanity and striving after the wind. Now it's interesting, up until now, God has been absent from the text. And it's when God appears in the text that we start seeing the light appear. That there is a glimmer of hope. There is some sort of ultimate meaning to all this. There is a purpose to life under the sun and the vanity of vanities. But it's not what we think it is. Now we've already touched on some of that. He's going to give a hint here. He's going to keep on expounding on the futility of life and the folly and wisdom and folly contrasted. And it's going to take until the end of the book in chapter 12 for us to get the final conclusion. But again, he says there is nothing better. There is no gain, there is no profit, there is no advantage in this life for our toil, because life under the sun was not meant for gain. It was meant for enjoyment. It was meant to be enjoyed for what it is, not what we think it ought to be. It was meant for us to enjoy as God designed it, not for how we want it to be or how we're going to conform it or how we can use it to our benefit and for our legacy. Pleasures, riches, wisdom, they're not meant for us to profit in any way. They're just meant to be enjoyed for their own sake. Wisdom can be enjoyed in the fact that we did not make the mistakes of our predecessors, or that we have the understanding of God's Word to rightfully apply to our own lives. That's a blessing in and of itself. Riches are a blessing and a tool to be used to benefit others, to be rich in good works, as James teaches. Pleasures are just given in this life to, in a sense, help us enjoy a life that is unpredictable and has ups and downs, and why do good things happen to bad people and bad things happen to good people? They're God's little acts of grace, if you want to think of them as that, in this twisted, messed up world. I might keep on going back to this one because I think it's so potent. Why is it that we have almost an infinite number of cuisines and flavor combinations? What benefit is there survival-wise to taste? Or what benefit is there in that? What's the point? Or what's the point of sugar and candy? There is no point. It's meant to be enjoyed. That's the whole thing. There's a reason why God gave us 10,000 taste buds. There's a reason why chocolate exists and desserts and candy and hamburgers and everything else. There's no point to any of that. And that's the point, in a sense. They're gifts to be enjoyed. As I said, they're gifts to be enjoyed while we have life under the sun. And again, I keep underlining this point. There is no gain, there is no profit, because life here under the sun that is not designed for profit. It's designed, as we're going to see at the end of the book in chapter 12. It's designed to live life, to glorify God, to fear Him and keep His commandments, and to enjoy the pleasures that He has given us on this short time we have here. Now, 26 is interesting. I want to spend just a couple minutes on 26 here. God has given to who is pleasing in His sight wisdom and knowledge and joy. Underline that joy there. That's God who's given those who are pleasing joy. But to the sinner, He has given the task of gathering and collecting, so He may give to the one who is good in God's sight. When you think of these two things contrasted, life is vanity and madness when it's pursued as gain. Life under the sun, irregardless of God, not thinking of God, of just trying to use what's in this life as a means for my own personal benefit. And there is a difference there between enjoyment. I can either enjoy life for what it is, or I can try and form it and mold it into my image and try and use it for my own purposes. I can either accept my lot in life where God has placed me, or I can try and buck against His authority and try and shape my own reality. But as we talk about Wednesday night, the funny thing is, when people, and this is an interesting comment by Jordan Peterson that he made in his practice of counseling people in psychology, says no one gets away with anything. People think they do, but they don't. When you bend reality, or try to, it snaps back. And you suffer the consequences. He's had it in his practice where somebody's life is a complete mess and he's able to trace it back where he to this person where they tried bending reality. They cheated on somebody. They weren't honest with their vows in a marriage, or they were trying to shape the world as they wanted it instead of how it is. So again, we shouldn't be surprised when we try and bend reality, it snaps back at us. That's, I think, part of God's design in it, on this world that we live in. But to the one who has accepted life for what it is, accepted the fact that, as we talk about here in verse 14 of chapter 12, that one fate befalls them both, that both the wise and the foolish are going to die. It is the wise, godly person who has accepted that fact and lives life in light of that fact. Because all these routes of pursuit and pleasure that Solomon took to explore, their make-believe lands that we do, that we engage in to try and hide the fact that we are mortal. I like what this author had to say here about Solomon's despair for just a moment. The reality is, if we do not understand or feel the way Solomon has felt in this text, the odds are we're putting off and we're ignoring death on some level. He goes on to say, the reality is that if death does not inform the way we live, then death is something we are pretending that doesn't exist. And whether we say we admit it or not, I think all of us who are going to be honest, who have come to grips with mortality and death, have felt as Solomon has felt, or at least we can empathize with how he is feeling. Now, what's the point if both the rich and the poor and the dumb and the smart all end up in the same place? But it is the wise person, once he's accepted life for what it is, not what it ought to be, but for reality, which Ecclesiastes is trying to help us to see, life then becomes one immense blessing. Every moment of every day is not taken for granted. Every pleasure, every joy that we have is savored and enjoyed for what God intended it to be. Rather than life being, woe is me, eat, drink, and be merry for tomorrow we die, life, understand correctly, through this lens of Ecclesiastes, is a life of joy. I like what one individual put it to me, talking with her today about this. Life really is just full of joy. And the reason why we don't see it as that, oftentimes, is because we are trying to conform and fit life to how we think it ought to be, instead of accepting it for how it is. And I go back to the eating thing. How many of us scarfed down breakfast today, ate lunch, without giving it any second thought? We'd probably rush through our breakfast if we did anything. We'd probably rush through lunch if we were trying to get someplace or didn't give any thought to that. And I've said before, but I think it underlines, what if our meals, our eating, is a daily blessing that we have so hastily and ungratefully overlooked? The fact that God gave us the intellect and the ideas to come up with these different flavor combinations of different ways to have that kind of food. Because again, God could have made us where we just get all the nutrients by photosynthesis. We just stand out for an hour, you know, stand out for 5 minutes a day or something, we're good to go. He designed us to eat. He designed us to have relationships. He's designed us to be have all these things. There's a benefit. There's a purpose behind that. And a lot of it is just joy. I want to end this with looking at that text one more time. There is nothing better for a person that he should eat, drink, and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw from the hand of God, from apart from him, who can eat or have enjoyment? For a person, verse 26, who is good in his sight, has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. To the one who has accepted life as it is, God has given these blessings. To the one who keeps on refusing and playing pretend, he will be just like Solomon. He will curse the sweat of his brow and throw up his hands and say, all was futility. Lord willing, next week we'll be looking at how Solomon goes into the fact that there is a time for everything. God is going back to these patterns of our life. But why all men, and bring this to a close here, all men must suffer death. That's the one common unifier between Bill Gates and you and I. We're all going to die one day. The hope of the gospel is, in Hebrews chapter 2, the fact there is one who has tasted death for all men, and that by him we can have victory over death. Look in the book of Hebrews chapter 2 as we bring this to a close here. The Hebrew writer quoting from Psalm 8 here, but he's quoted from Psalm 8, what is man that you even think of him or give thought to him? You look in verse 9, he says, but we do see him who was made for a little while lower than the angels, namely Jesus, because of the suffering of death, crowned him with glory and honor, so by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. Jesus died the agonizing death on the cross so that he might render powerless the power of death. And if you are here tonight and not yet a Christian, you can be united with Christ in the waters of baptism. And through Christ, you too can have the victory over death. And you can start enjoying life for what it is, instead of what you think it ought to be. But know this, that if you continue to live life under the sun according to the world, I wouldn't be surprised in a few short years that you find yourself in the same place as Solomon, pulling your hair out, going, this is agony, this is useless. But you're trying to find meaning in things that can give no meaning. If you've done that in the past and need prayers of restoration, prayers of strength, or you need to come forward to confess sin of a public nature, please do so now, see how we stand and sing the song of invitation.